Hey guys, welcome to the first podcast for me outside of Fieldcraft Survival, the Kevin Owens podcast. That is sounds so weird, and we may change the name later, but this is the first one that I'm doing on my own. So if you're listening and you're like, who the hell is this guy with the weird accent? Let me explain kind of where I'd like to bring this and how I'd like to do it, because podcasts are a new form of really getting the word out there to like our customer base at Fieldcraft Survival and generally the hardworking people of America, because Instagram used to be a mechanism for marketing and getting the word out there. Instagram has become TikTok. It's garbage and it's quick turn, and no matter what you put on there, you have people running their mouth and second guessing it, even though they have no idea what they're looking at. So a podcast gives you, a podcast on YouTube, they give you a chance to explain things and get that longer form content. So this first one I'm going to do, I'm going to try to keep them around 30, 40 minutes. I'm just going to kind of explain where I want to bring this and my background a little bit and where I come from, because some of you may know who I am. Most of you probably have no idea. And I have done Cleared Hot with Andy Stomp. I've done Mike Ritland's podcast. I don't do that many. But here we are. I got out of the army. Well, let me go back at the start. I grew up in Ireland. That's why I have this weird Irish-American accent that you can't place. And I hope it's not too annoying, because to me it's like nails on a chalkboard. But I grew up in Ireland and lived there till I was 25. I grew up with a big family, 14 kids, went in the army in Ireland, spent 7 years in the army, a little bit in the infantry, a little bit in special operations, got out, did some contract work, bounced around a little bit around the world, and then ended up in America with a green card and joined the American Army and spent 24 years in the US Army, 6 in the infantry and 18 in special forces. So when I get out, I started working for Fieldcraft Survival as a training manager and running classes, because the CEO, Mike Glover, and I were on the same team in Special Forces, and we were good friends. When I got out of the Army after 24 years, I had no social media whatsoever. I didn't want any. I barely had an email address. So I remember I said to Mike, "Mike, can I come and teach and work for you and stay anonymous?" And it wasn't that I thought I was a freaking ninja, because I'm not. I just kind of a private person. And Mike said, "No, you can't. People need to know who they're training with and what your background is. It gives you credibility." So I was like, okay. So I did a couple of posts on Instagram. Mike actually had to show me how to do a post on Instagram. And my whole world didn't come falling apart. And I was like, okay, this is not that bad. Now a couple of years later, I have like 70,000 followers on Instagram. I have a YouTube channel, and now I have a podcast. Amazing how things evolve. And to me, it's just that next step. I looked at it as the next step in my career, that this is something I have to do in order to be successful. And you get a lot of special operations guys who retire and they think they're ninjas and they don't want to do it. And I will tell you, it doesn't matter what a badass you are. If people have no idea who you are, then if you want to do training, then they're not going to train with you, right? And there is a lot of veterans now. Mike Glover was one of the first people to get out of the special operations community and start this type. He's been on podcasts now for years and years and years, and social media, and he was kind of at the forefront of it. There's tons and tons and tons of guys right now, but they're all doing the same thing. And it is, I look at it and it's not what I want to do. It's just not. I want to be a little different. And I tell you what you will get from me always, always, always is the truth, honesty. And it bites me in the ass a lot. People don't want to hear it. People pretend they want to hear the truth, but they really don't. But you're going to get the truth from me. So if you have questions that you want me to address, let me know and I will lay it out for you. All right? I'm here in Fort Bragg, and I'll go through that here in a minute, but I have a large network of people I know here, but I'm not just going to keep interviewing veterans, because a lot of them are the same story. I grew up in America, I played high school football, got out, joined the Army, went to Ranger Regiment, went to SF, went to Delta, went to Iraq and Afghanistan. It's kind of the same story over and over again, unless there's something different in there. One of the best ones I did so far is on Fieldcraft Survival when I interviewed Chuck Ritter. Chuck's a Sergeant Major in SF still, and Chuck's been shot and blown up a bunch of times. And he also is a funny, quirky guy who doesn't take himself too seriously, and I like that. I will not interview people that just think they are some sort of badass and everybody needs to bow down to them, because I know what you do and I know what you did in SF and I'm not impressed, all right? Sorry, that's that no filter coming out again. Okay, so I will interview some guys. I will try to make it entertaining, right? Entertaining and educational, if I can. That's my goal. So no broad, very broad spectrum. Don't care if you're a veteran. Don't care if you're spent a day in the Army. If you have an interesting story, I'd love to sit down and chat with you. Okay, so let me, for the people who have absolutely no idea who I am or what I've done in my life, and if you're still tuned in, my voice might not be annoying you too much, but let me kind of break it down for you in a broad storyline. I grew up in Ireland. I was born in Ireland with a big family, 14 kids, two parents in a small house that was owned by the council. My old man was a bricklayer. He built houses, construction. He got hurt on the job and then he never kind of went back. He struggled with alcoholism, which is quite common in Ireland, at least it was back then. And but I had a great childhood. You don't know you're poor when you're poor. And as we always had food, we always had what we need to get through. So I have eight sisters and five brothers, and then my parents in a small, small house. You were never alone. I enjoy solitude now immensely because I grew up like that. My mom was the strongest person I've ever met in my life. She was a rock star. She ruled with an iron fist. And she would beat that ass if you stepped out of line, and she had to, because she was the disciplinarian, because my old man wasn't, my dad wasn't really involved in that. And she would go, like, we had no car, she would get on a bus and go in and do groceries for 16 people and come back on the bus with groceries. I imagine, today, that doesn't even just, I can't even imagine that. And she always paid her bills. She always kept our head above water. She got us all educated and we all turned out really well, which is kind of a tough thing to do when you have 14 kids and nobody ever went to jail and we're all quite successful in our own way. And we're all very different, but that's how families are. When she passed, it devastated us all. I'll get to that part. So grew up tough, grew up fighting, grew up breaking into shops and breaking into factories and stealing shit, and breaking into pubs and stealing beer, grew up fighting, grew up drinking. But I grew up tough, and that has stood to me to this day. Not a lot bothers me in that realm. When I went to Catholic school, that didn't work out that well, but I went to Catholic school, got a good education, but when I get out, when I hit about 15, 16, I started getting a little wild. And that's when I started breaking into stuff and getting into fights and all that kind of thing. And I think I just grew up with a lot of anger and I grew up with a lot of misdirected energy. And that's, the military is great for taking that misdirected energy and pointing it in a certain direction. And it has helped me and it's probably helped thousands and thousands of people out there in every country around the world. You take that young man with a desire to kind of do something worthwhile and you point him in the right direction and you put non-commissioned officers in charge of him and they kick his ass into line and they instill a little discipline in him and he turns out quite well. So when I was coming out of high school, I was like, what the hell am I going to do? And me and my buddy were going to go to the French Foreign Legion. And again, it's that drive to serve that if that is not fulfilled, it's very hard. And I feel sorry. I met a young man in Nashville a couple of months ago, and he told me that he tried to go in the military because he had that urge to serve. And some sort of medical issue he had earlier on in his life, and they wouldn't take him, right? So now he drives a truck, and dude, I can't remember your name if you're listening. Shout out to you, man. You're crushing it. The but he's always got that kind of gap in his life that he feels like he should have went there. And looking back like that, it leads nowhere, but it's hard to turn that off. That's why when people ask me, hey, I'm 25 or I'm 30 and I want to go in the military, I've always wanted to go in, but I feel like I'm too old. I'd be like, hey, if you don't do it now, you'll be 45 and you'll regret it. And you'll look back and go, damn, I had the opportunity and I missed it, okay? So I had that urge to serve and I wanted to go to French Foreign Legion. And at the time, like you're talking 1985, right? So the war in Northern Ireland was going crazy. It had been going through really bad throughout the 70s, got really bad in the 80s. And then in the mid 90s, it went into a peace treaty and all that kind of thing. But it was a very complex conflict, but it was every day growing up and it became very, very accustomed to it. There was we could hear bombs. I grew up just south of the border and we could hear bombs going off in Northern Ireland sometimes. So you grew up a conflict, you grew up in that in kind of rough environment and you need to point that in a certain direction and go a certain way. So me and my best friend were going to go to French Foreign Legion. We were going to get on a boat from Ireland, get the ferry over to Le Havre in France. And then we had the place mapped out. And we knew where we were going. And we would have been successful. We would have made it. And it was just, look, I had no desire to be in the French army. However, you could not join the Irish army at the time. They didn't recruit. Tiny little army, 10,000 people, probably still the same size, small country. And they only recruited when they needed soldiers, right? So they would put out a call and say, hey, we're training a platoon. And we have 30 slots, right? And then hundreds of people would apply because there was no jobs. Ireland was in a really bad recession at the time. It was extremely difficult to get a job. Most people went to England, they went to America, or they went on the dole on welfare. And if you could get a job in the government, it was very solid. Excuse me, you're never going to get laid off. And it was like a really good job to have, right? So me and my buddy put our names down for the army. It was funny because we were, and I apologize if you heard this story before, but we were thinking about going in the army, but we didn't know anything about it typically, right? No internet back then. But we knew this guy called Tony who'd been in the army for 3 years and get out. And he was an IRA guy, supposedly, and I would believe that. But he was like, we used to meet him in the pub sometimes and he was a funny guy. He was hilarious, right? So we cornered Tony in the pub one night and we're like, Tony, tell us about the army. And he told us about basic training. He told us this, that, the other. He told us all the good stuff, all the bad stuff. And it was really good. But I remember one story he told us where him and a friend of his, they were living in the barracks. And in the barracks there, they have military police, like here in the States, but they have military police on the gates and all that, but because of the war in Northern Ireland. But him and his buddy were going out one Saturday night. They were all dressed up. They were going drinking, meeting girls, whatever. And the MP stopped them at the gate and sent them over to their mess hall. And they had to make 1,000 sandwiches for an officer's function. And Tony was telling us that he said his mate, like call him John or whatever it was, John spat on 500 sandwiches. Every sandwich he made, he spat on it. And Tony was like, I could only spit on like 300 sandwiches and I was out. I couldn't do it anymore. So the lesson learned, don't mess with the enlisted man's drinking time. So Tony gave us the whole skinny on the army and it didn't deter us. So we went in and put our name down, but we didn't hear anything for almost a year. And it was at that point we're like, screw this, we're going into the French Foreign Legion. So while we were getting ready to roll, boom, the army called, putting a platoon together and they're training. So we went in and interviewed. I didn't think I did particularly well in an interview because I'd never had an interview before, but apparently I did okay because I got in. And there was 30 recruits taken into my local town. And it's not like America where you go to a big central base. Maybe it is now, but back then you trained in your hometown and you served in your hometown. And there was no academy. Basically the local company detailed a couple of NCOs, said you're training recruits for the next 6 months, boom, go. And that's what we did. So I went in there, got in processed and got all my gear. And then went in the army. And I've had a long, very successful military career, but it did not start that well. All the words of command for marching were on Gaelic. the Irish language, which I, even though I'd studied it in school, I couldn't speak any of it. I can speak more Arabic today than I can speak Gaelic, right? So a lot of the guys in my squad or section, as we call them, they'd been in the reserves for the army. So they already knew all the drill and commands and all the Gaelic words. And I didn't know any of them. And it was rough. I remember marching in a file this way, kind of with me at the front of it and everybody else behind me. And they gave the command for everybody to turn. And I didn't know what they were saying. So I just kept walking and I was on my own. I got disciplined pretty heavy in those first in that first week or so. But once I got it, I got quite good at it. And the whole soldiering thing came very, very natural to me for some reason. I remember they had an award at the end of training for the best soldier. And I remember somebody saying to me, "You'll probably get that." And I was shocked because I was like, "What? No way." And he was like, and then he laid it out. "Look, you're always on time. You're physically fit. Your uniform's always squared away." And I was just doing what I was told. It's like Forrest Gump, right? It was like, "What's your job, Gump?" And it's like, "To do whatever you tell me, drill sergeant." He's like, "You're a goddamn genius." So the army's very easy, and the army's very, very good for a young man who's kind of got a lot of demons and a lot of crazy stuff going on in his head. So we trained, and we trained hard. We trained, I think, and if my numbers are a little bit off, it's been a long time. We trained for 4 months, I think, for basic training, and then we did an extra month or two for advanced training, right? So during the basic training, there was 30 of us, and we were split into sections, 10-man sections, I think. And we had two instructors per section. So in comparison, in the American military, when you go to basic training and you train at Fort Benning or Fort Jackson, wherever you go, you basically have two drill sergeants for every 30 students, right? Whereas there we had two for every 10. So you got some serious personal attention and you really didn't get away with much. They hammered us pretty hard because when you think about it, those NCOs who were training us would end up serving with us. Once we graduated basic training and advanced training, we were standing on the border with those guys. We were in Lebanon with those guys side by side. So they had a vested interest in making us as good as we could possibly be. And of course, at the time, you don't kind of think that way. But during the training, I kind of took to it like a fish to water. And I found it, once you get over that, and if you go to basic training anywhere, it's like this. Once you get over that initial shock and, you know, the culture shock of you're not getting to sleep and you have no control over your life and you're doing this and doing that. Now, once you get over that after a week or something, it becomes very routine. And the human body and the human mind can get used to a lot. So it becomes very natural. So we went through all that basic training. It was really good. And it was, I will say, very well structured. And now this is me thinking back from 30 years ago or more, right? But I remember the gear we got was not very good, but it's a good place to start. It's good to start with humble beginnings, right? So we didn't have like a combat uniform when we got there first. They gave us coveralls, right? One piece coveralls. And I have a picture posted on my Instagram of me standing there with an FNFAL and my coveralls on. And I look like I'm like 12, but I was 18. And so we got coveralls. We had 1956 pattern web gear, right? So our web gear was like the harness with the pouches and the ammo or the canteens. But it was garbage. It was obviously made by the cheapest bidder, and the hooks that kept the ammo pouches and the canteens to your belt, as soon as they put weight in them, they would just bend and straighten out, and everything would fall off the first time you did it. It was made in 1956, right? So the backpack was crap. The helmet was crap. Actually, the helmet went bad. We had adopted the Israelis helmet at that point, and it was decent. The weapons, FNFAL, classic rifle, but I'm not a big dude, and it was freaking 9.5 pounds loaded. No, it was 9.5 pounds unloaded, 11 pounds loaded with a 20-round mag. But hey, I rocked that thing. NCOs had the Carl G M45 submachine gun, which, again, it's a classic submachine gun, but it's a bolt and a spring and a barrel. It's skin and bone, man. But it did the job. And then we had the Mag 58, which in American metal you'd call it the 240 Bravo machine gun, but it that was taken from the Mag 58 made by FN in 1958. We had that as a Beltwell 7.62 weapon. We had Carl Gustav Rokolis rifle. We had 50 cals. Trying to think what else we had. Yeah, it wasn't like it was very, very light infantry focused. But went through all the training, went through all the weapons, did everything in a bunch of exercises out in the mountains, and graduated, did some advanced training. And I remember like when we graduated and completely finished all our training, I graduated on a Friday and I was on border patrol on a Sunday. And I think me and a buddy of mine volunteered for it because we were so excited. We'd soon get to be sick of doing that duty, but we were on border patrol. So where I grew up and where I served was in Dundalk, which is not very far south of the Northern Ireland border. So those units on the border would constantly patrol that border. And, you know, you have multiple threats, IRA, and Protestant paramilitaries coming across the border and bombing in this side, because that had happened in the past. They'd actually caught the SAS crossing the border before and rolled them up. And there was always stuff going on. But when I was in the infantry, I did 7 24-hour duties a month, right? So you would be on 24 hours on, 24 hours off for a week. And then you'd have a week of normal, you know, 8 to 4:30 normal duties, right? And then you'd go, so you would do Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and Sunday 1 week. And then the next week would be normal. Then you would do Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday the next week. So you do 7 24 hours duties a month. And one of those duty would be guard on the base. And, you know, it's funny to look back, but you don't know what you don't know. Like the guard on the base was absolutely ridiculous. It was, there was a guardhouse by the gate, and there was a couple of cells in there in case you had somebody got locked up. And you had four privates and a non-commissioned officer in there for 24 hours, but there was nobody allowed to sleep, right? Now, so you had to stay up the whole time. If you were caught sleeping, it would be a huge deal. Now, what is the harm in putting two people down and letting them get some damn sleep? Because you're better when you're actually on guard duty. Because there was one guy on a roving thing on the outside, on post. There was one NCO on the inside, and there was basically three guys there sitting playing cards. There was no TV, no radio, nothing. It was very, very old school, archaic way of thinking, but nobody would ever change it. And the Irish Army was, and probably still is, completely run by officers. So they don't do any of those duties. So why do they care? And there was no mindset for change, okay? So the guard duty was the worst one. The border patrol stuff was better because you had 16 men, four Land Rovers with four in each. Each Land Rover had a driver, an NCO, a non-commissioned officer, corporal, which is kind of like a staff sergeant in the American Army, and two privates in the back. And you moved as two vehicles together, and you went out at intermittent times and patrolled the border. The police were not armed along the border in Ireland, which is ridiculous. I'm sure they probably are now, but so they had no guns in the most violent and terrorist-ridden country in Europe at the time. So anytime they moved along the border, they needed a military escort. And we were there to, they called it aid to the civil power, and it was to be on checkpoints and searches and cordons and all that stuff, right? So we would be on duty for 24 hours, and then you would either get called out if something happened, or you'd just kind of hang out and wait until your shift came, and then you would go out and drive along. And I much preferred to be out driving along the border than to be stuck in that room. I remember the room we were in. It's funny how you remember little details from decades ago, but you can't remember what happened last week. I remember the room we were in. It was an old school barracks room that was probably built by the British Army. And the British Army left in the 1920s, but it was old, it was dirty, because you had 16 guys coming in every 24 hours. And they would clean up after them, but it was nasty. The beds had those old army blankets on them that probably had more diseases than a freaking a bed sheet in Bangkok, right? But it was a place where when you get soldiers and you put them somewhere and you get them bored, then that's where practical jokes happen, right? I remember they used to get, in the summer, it was super hot in there, and somebody would inevitably fall asleep on their bed in their uniform. And then a couple of guys would proceed to put as many heavy army blankets on them as possible until they sweated so much they basically passed out. And that was considered humor. I remember all the classics, like the cling film on the toilet. I remember, like, it was just out of control, and it was expected, right? But then when you went out on the border, you jumped in the back of a Land Rover, and it was okay in the summer, but in the winter it was brutal. And the cops would be driving around their police car with their shirts and their sleeves rolled up in their heated car, and we'd be in these Land Rovers and driving around freezing our ass off. We had those old flak vests that they had in Vietnam that will not stop a bullet, and they're just cumbersome. The rules of engagement were read to us every single time we left. So I'm at 25 minutes. So every time we left, they would come in and an officer would come in and read us the rules of engagement. And it went like this. There's five times, and I can talk about this because it's all in the past, but there's not a lot I learned in my life with all the shit I've done that I can't talk about. There are five times you could open fire. Defense of your own life, defense of your comrade's life, to protect your post, to stop yourself being forcibly disarmed, and to prevent serious damage to government property. Those are the five times we were told we could open fire. But you had to have justification, prevention, compliance with the law, and minimum force, right? You had to have justification for every separate act of force. So if I shoot you, I can't walk up and kick you, right? That's the same here. Justification, prevention, I have to be preventing you doing something. Compliance with the law, you're still a law-abiding citizen, and then minimum force. You have to use the minimum amount of force needed to complete the action, right? Now, the rules of engagement change periodically, and I was so young and I really didn't know, but I remember at one point they said you cannot go above the speed limit, right? Which was 55 miles an hour, kilometers an hour, whatever. And we have these Land Rovers, right? So what would happen was, and what happened was the police would get into, they'd set up a checkpoint, an IRA vehicle would come, they'd see it, they'd do a 180 and haul ass, right? And the cops would speed after them at 70 miles an hour. And the Army Land Rover would come chugging along at 55 miles an hour and lose them. So by the time those Land Rovers found the cops, they were tied and gagged and thrown into the side of the ditch and the IRA, because they had guns and the cops didn't have any guns, right? Which is stupid. So the rules changed. And they said, I remember distinctly, they read them to us and they said, if there's a high-speed pursuit, you will keep up with the police, but you will not drive recklessly, right? And this is where I started to realize that officers don't have my best interest at heart. And I'm sorry if you're an officer, but good learning from you. Because think about that. If there's a high-speed pursuit, you will keep up with the police, but you will not drive recklessly. All that does, it's a catch-22, right? If I don't keep up with the police, then I'm wrong. But if I do keep up with the police, but I wreck the vehicle, then I'm wrong. It's a way to cover your ass for officers, right? Or for the people above, right? And I will never forget, they read that to us, and we had a sergeant who'd been in the British Army, and he was like a grumpy guy, but would call people out and wasn't afraid of officers like a lot of other NCOs. And he was like, no, I am not sending my men out with those rules. Change it now. And he crushed this officer, and they didn't know what to do with him because he was just the type of guy that was like, I'm not doing it. I'm not doing it. And it eventually got changed. But that's a catch-22 right there. And it's ridiculous. That was the ridiculous rules. I remember that guy as well. I can't remember if it was him or another guy. When we did a border patrol, they would have to write a patrol report. And that guy wrote, I don't know if it's him, maybe somebody else. They wrote, okay, we left here at this time. We checked out border crossing 28, 29, 30, 34. We did a checkpoint at this grid. And then we came back. Whatever he wrote. And the officer on duty said, can you give me more detail? I need more details. So the next one he did, woke up, opened my eyes, sat on my bed, put my left boot on, put my right boot on, stood up, tied both legs, like he went into excruciating detail just to make a point. What officers don't understand about NCOs, and I've seen this my entire career, we're not going to push you in front of the bus. We don't have to pull you out of the way when the bus is coming. Because So there's a delicate balance with dealing with non-commissioned officers, especially experienced ones. And I know it's difficult for officers to deal with guys like that, like me, and sometimes. But if you do your job, then you'll be okay. So, again, often, I have millions of stories, right? Maybe not millions, hundreds. But if you told me now, tell me a story, I wouldn't be able to think of one. But as I go through stuff, things pop in my head that I haven't thought about in decades. So that's where it all comes from. Border Patrol. So I, as a young soldier in the 27th Infantry Battalion in Dundalk, patrolling the border, we did cash escorts and explosive escorts. So a cash escort was if they were moving a large amount of money from bank to bank. And I heard that the number one time was like £1 million or whatever. I don't know if that's true, but they were afraid that the IRA would hit the armored truck. And so they put a military and police escort on it, right? So police car, Land Rover, armored truck, another Land Rover. And we would go with them, go bank to bank to bank, picking up all the money. And it was kind of a cool duty because you're in the city, you're in the towns, you can look at girls, you can freak, it's less boring than being on the freaking, on the border. And it wasn't like the IRA couldn't take the money if they freaking wanted it, right? We were a deterrent. In order to get this money, you have to kill 8 soldiers and 2 cops. And they just weren't willing to do that because politically it would be suicide, right? The country would turn against you, right? So we did that. And then we did explosive escorts as well. We would go to a big explosive warehouse where they kept all this stuff. And we would go with the cops and escort it to a quarry. They would use what they needed at the quarry. And then we would supervise the burning of anything left. So that was another duty we did. And intermittently we did training and we did all kinds of stuff that some of it was BS and some of it was good. I also, in 1987, you could volunteer to go to Lebanon. And Lebanon was part of a peacekeeping mission that they call it UNIFIL, United Nations Interim Force in Lebanon, right? And it was part of a UN mission that the Irish Army had to provide a battalion every 6 months. So what appealed to me is going to see another part of the world. I hadn't been out of Ireland. I think I went to England once, but hadn't really been out of Ireland. Hadn't really been anywhere. And it gave me an opportunity to go to the Middle East, which is a pretty fascinating place. It also meant that you got double your pay. So you still got your Irish Army pay, and then you got paid by the UN, and I think it was about double. So in 6 months, you can make a year's pay, which is a pretty attractive offer. Now, people had been killed in Lebanon. Soldiers had been killed. I personally know people who had been killed. They had not really been targeted much at the time. They would hit an IED, a roadside bomb, a landmine. They get hit with stray rounds. There was some targeting done. But basically, your mission was to provide a buffer between militia units in South Lebanon and the Israeli army. So in order to prevent rockets being shot into Israel, they moved into South Lebanon, the Israeli army, and occupied all the high ground. And so it was like the rocket shooting sites would be a couple of miles in and they wouldn't be able to launch into Israel and hit anything, that, like no cities and stuff, right? So basically the job of the UN there was monitoring and reporting Israeli movements and then manning checkpoints to stop the Hezbollah and the Amman militia and the PLO early on from attacking the Israeli outposts, right? Now, how effective were we? I don't know. I have a ton of stories about that mission, but it was really cool. I went there twice. I went there the first time as a private, and the second time as a non-commissioned officer out of special operations. But the first time I went, I signed up, wanted the money, wanted the adventure, and wanted to go do some sort of something cool, right? Now, if you go and work for the United Nations and you have a warrior mindset, you are in the wrong place because that organization does not want you. And I found that out really quickly. So my platoon, we had a platoon from the border, it was a platoon from Dublin or, and one from another part of the border, right? We all performed, we all made up a company. And again, I was a private. We went out there. We had an attachment from an NCO who was from the Ranger Wing, right? Very professional guy, very, very squared away and knowledgeable, but like way too gung-ho for the United Nations. And that I'm not bashing him because I was like that too. I had a different mindset than they wanted. They don't want conflict. They want to de-escalate. They want nothing to do with it. And in hindsight, right back now when I look at it, they really want to die in a foreign country for freaking something where you're not making any difference, right? So we would go out there. You'd either be in an observation post up in the mountains, or you'd be on a checkpoint, or you'd be in a house or a camp where you would feed a checkpoint and man a checkpoint. And each one had kind of different performance parameters. I remember, and I found this odd, because I remember getting on site in country and not really understanding the players and not really understanding the culture and not really understanding how we got where we were. Like, nobody had ever explained. I was fairly well educated, but nobody had explained about the nation of Israel being formed after World War II, right? Nobody had explained the conflict up to that point. Nobody had really explained Arab culture, the do's and don'ts. And I look back at it after a life in the army and a lot of special operations and a lot of time in the Middle East, and I'm like, how could you not teach that stuff? And it's not like, it wasn't part of the formal POI and the training leading up to going. So nobody just did it. And most of the NCOs, and they didn't know either, I assume. Now, some of them had already been there and done trips. You would think they would take it on themselves to go, people really need to know this stuff. But we didn't. And we got out there and you kind of figured it out as you went along. So we got there, we flew from Dublin to Tel Aviv, and then we took a bus up to the border, and then we took a truck to the area of operations. I got in like super late at night and got our weapons. And again, I volunteered for guard duty like a jackass because I was so excited. And I remember being on the top of I went to a hill called Hill 80 in South Lebanon the first night I got there. And the guy who was already there was at the end of his 6 months tour. But I remember seeing streams of tracers fly across the sky at night and tank rounds being fired. I was like, oh my God, we're really in it now. And it was a weird relationship because you're reporting on the Israeli movements, and the Israelis didn't even have Israeli soldiers in most of these hilltop positions. They had Christian militia that were getting the ability to let their family go into Israel at work, right? So it was people from, they're called the South Lebanese Army, and they were Christian militia who manned all these OPs, and they had a horrible life up there, and they'll get attacked all the time. But they were pretty brutal themselves. So we were reporting all that movement. We were dealing with that. Now, the trip before ours, the commander had not stopped anybody on the checkpoints. He kind of let them all through. Well, our commander got there kind of gung-ho, and he was like, we're stopping everybody, we're searching every car. And that created a massive problem, because if you have these militia guys that are like, they're like the police, right? The Amal militia were less militia-y than the Hezbollah, right? The Hezbollah are just nut jobs, right? So they'd been used to moving around at will, and now all of a sudden these Irish guys with their blue berets and their lightly armed their machine gun and their couple of rifles are going to stop me? Oh, hell no, right? So what they would do is they would cause a problem. Now, they don't want to kill us either, right? Because we were at advantageous presence for both sides. The Israelis, even though we were reporting their movement, we were only stopping them because they didn't give a crap what the UN said. The militia, we were stopping the Israelis from rolling in like they did in 1982 and just taking over South Lebanon, which they've done since. So it's kind of advantageous for both sides to keep us there. It's also, the Irish that were there had money to spend on the local economy, and some of the other United Nations units from like Nigeria and places like, they didn't have money. So the people in the local vet wanted to keep us there, right? So you're playing this kind of middle of the road game. But they would cause an incident on a checkpoint. And you had NCOs and soldiers who were told, stop these guys. And after curfew, you'd see the car coming from miles away and you'd be like, oh Jesus, here we go. And they would get out, they'd fire, they'd shoot. They weren't trying to kill anybody. They were trying to cause an incident. You'd end up in a big Mexican standoff. Then the officer would come down after getting out of bed because he didn't do anything else, and he would let them through. Now, again, at the time, I was a young soldier, but I was like, that's jacked up. We just risked our life to stop these guys, and you come down and just let them through. What are we doing here? And it was very, very kind of frustrating to be part of that, right? And then what they did was they issued them passes. The guys who'd pulled guns on us, who'd grabbed, there was one incident, I've told it before, and it was about clearing, I tell it in a personal security class, and it's about clearing a malfunction. There was one incident where the NCO had that small M45 Carl Gustav, and you cock that thing to the rear and hook it in, and it's the same as a Sten gun, a Sterling, and very, very common thing, right? But in order to fire that, you have to move that bolt forward. So, we're at 41 minutes, I'm going to wrap up the end of the story. The NCO stopped this car, and he had that bolt cocked to the rear. The guy jumped out, he put his hand right over the top of the NCO, and he grabbed the weapon in such a way that he couldn't put the bolt forward, right? And he had a Browning Hypar handgun in the other hand, and he was shooting at the sentries that were out on the three positions leading cars into, it's called Tibnian Bridge. And he was firing at them, keeping them at bay, and they were trying to get a shot at him, but they couldn't. And then he had a malfunction with the handgun. And anybody who's used handguns, and you know, you got to let go of whatever you have in your left hand. You got to slap open that magazine, rack the slide, and get that malfunction cleared. So the NCO, his name was Jerry, a good dude. He was, Jerry was thinking, and I talked to Jerry after this. And I was on, it was the same trip I was on, but, and I was not physically there when this happened, but Jerry was thinking, when he takes his hand off the weapon to clear the malfunction, I'll be able to put it in operation and shoot him, right? Well, the guy gets a malfunction and he grabs the slide with his teeth and racks the slide with his teeth and clears the malfunction. And we're like, damn, that just happened, right? Oh my God. So pretty hardened militia fighters, but they knew how to play the game against the UN. Little incident here, threaten some of them, maybe kill a few of them, and then they'll back off. And it always happened. And it was a roller coaster like that, right? There was a bunch more incidents like that on that trip. It was kind of eye-opening. It was a great trip. I made a lot of money. Got to go to Israel, got to go to Cyprus. Got to travel in the Middle East a little bit, and it was very, very eye-opening. But I saw it as, you know, the UN, big white vehicles, blue berets. I was on an OP way out in the middle of nowhere, very, very far out, called Atiri. It was a house, and we had officers driving around in armored vehicles doing their little patrol thing. This last story, and I'll wrap up. And I remember you're standing on this roof of this house pulling guard, and they have a light shining on the roof. Now, if you're a soldier or if you have any sense at all, that's the dumbest thing you could do, because everybody around can see you and you can't see anything. And so I would take the bulb out when I was on duty. And then this officer came by and he would freaking yell at me and, hey, we're UN, we're supposed to be high profile, blah, blah, blah. And he made me put the bulb back in. As soon as he leave, I'd take the bulb out again. I did it multiple times. And then I smashed the damn thing because I was like, I am not standing on this freaking roof. So I've been a bit of an ass since I was a private, apparently. But common sense needs to prevail in a dangerous place, right? So did that, got back, and I'm at about 44 minutes now. So I'm going to wrap up this first section, and I'm going to write down where I ended up, and I will pick it up here on the next one, right? I don't know if you guys find this, you know, any way entertaining. You can hit me up on Instagram. You can email me, Kevin at fieldcraftsurvival.com. and let me know. I'm trying to steer this. I have no idea what I'm doing here. Big surprise. I'm just trying to kind of talk through a storyline and remember stories as I do it. But there's been a lot of lessons learned over my very long career that I'd like young soldiers to freaking learn now without having to learn them the hard way. So I'll pick it up here the next time. And if you have questions, please hit me up. And this podcast is sponsored by nobody, right? No ads. There you go. Actually, here's your ad. Fieldcraft Training. Check out Fieldcraft Training on Instagram. And check out Fieldcraft Survival for the training page. We have training all over the country. And we have phenomenal instructors. We have weeded our instructors down to a small core element that are vetted, mature adults with experience, that awesome experience. And they will give you that knowledge that they have, and they're passionate about teaching. So please check out our training. There's nothing that can substitute good training with professional instructors. All right. Thanks, guys. Next time. Until next time.